At a ceremony in England today commemorating tomorrow's 75th anniversary of D-Day, 99-year-old British veteran John Jenkins looked back.
I'm honoured to be stood here today in front of so many other veterans. You never forget your comrades because we're all in it together.
D-Day was the largest naval, air, and land invasion in history, what our next guest calls the Big War, fought by the Allies on the land, in the air, on the sea, while the Germans were forced to fight largely on land. But fight they did at daybreak on June 6, 1944, as wave after wave of British, American, and Canadian troops landed on five different beaches along the Normandy coastline. They were met with, mowed down by the full force of German troops in a battle that went on for nearly 6 weeks. You may have seen it in movies like Saving Private Ryan or The Longest Day, but the movies don't tell the whole story, and soon those who lived through it won't tell it at all. Historians like James Holland will. He's a British historian. His new book is called Normandy 44, D-Day and the Battle for France. He joins us now. James, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And can you give us context? France had fallen to the Germans. In fact, in 1944, Nazi Germany had occupied much of Europe for 4 years and had invaded Russia as well. Britain, amazingly, had held off the Nazi bombings. Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, the U.S., 3 years earlier, 1941. But you have these allies, the British, the U.S., Canada. They knew they had to, like, to use a sports metaphor, they had to throw the long ball. They had to do something big.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, right from the word go, both the U.S. and the British were absolutely determined that they were going to use steel, not flesh, as far as possible, and fight using their assets and prioritizing correctly. So, you know, both Britain and America have huge industrial power, huge global reach, modernity, science, and they were going to harness all of that and resources to fight a war which was going to be industrially heavy, very mechanized. That's very different to how everybody else was fighting. You know, the Germans, the Russians, the Japanese, it's all about boots on the ground. You know, it's about numbers of manpower, really, more than anything else.
Well, when you say innovation, one of my treasured keepsakes is a little black and white photo I have of General James Gavin. He was standing with, I think, General Eisenhower in a field in the Midwest. And it was Gavin who came up with the idea of putting troops in parachutes and parachuting troops in. So there was innovation there. There was, as you say, all the steel. They pretty much held off the German aircraft. So the Germans were forced to just fight with what they had on the ground.
Well, one of the key things about D-Day, one of the key prerequisites was to make sure that they had completely control of the airspace over the, not just the invasion, planned invasion beaches, but over most of Northwest Europe. And they pulled it off. And they pulled it off by having superior aircraft, more aircraft, better tactics, higher skilled pilots. And on the face of it, you'd have thought the Germans would win because they're already on land, whereas the Allies have got to get it across the English Channel. So that's where air power comes in, because you've got to destroy all the bridges, destroy their communication network, destroy their radar, roads, locomotives, and all the rest of it, and slow up the Germans' ability to strengthen the bridgehead in Normandy. And they managed to do that incredibly successfully.
Well, you say, in fact, we should pay more attention to what happened in the air. But it's hard to when we've seen these images of what happened on the ground. We see wave after wave of these troops just spilling out of containers onto the beaches where they were just mowed down. But you remind us that Allied leaders, this was so important to turn back the Nazis at this point, that they were braced for as many as 40,000 casualties on the first day alone. It was 10,000, but still, that's enormous. And then, you know, 6,000 a day, again, in injured, wounded, and dead.
Two of the things that really struck me on my research was one that, you know, it wasn't like the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan across the board, not even on Omaha Beach. And even in the first wave, which is what that's supposed to be depicting, i.e. the troops that are landing at 6:30 in the morning, it wasn't a wholesale slaughter. And if you look at after action reports, it's quite interesting because officers, platoon commanders are saying, you know, cross beach with one dead and two wounded and this kind of thing. It just depended on where you landed and what time you landed, to be perfectly honest. There were two kind of particularly bad killing zones for the Americans and very much in those first waves. But if you look at pictures of troops landing at 10 in the morning, they're getting off the beaches, you know, really without too much trouble.
Well, thank
and
God.
You have to remember what it's like for the Germans. You know, it was horrific. Don't get me wrong. And I'm not trying to belittle it in any way. But you know, if you're a German defender, there was kind of 350 of you on the crust at Omaha Beach, and you're being attacked by 183 offshore naval guns, in as well as vast numbers of cannons, plus the troops on the ground. You know, smoke soon obscures you from your firing line with your machine gun. There's grit coming down in your bunker and dust, and, you know, your barrels are overheating in your machine gun. So it's horrific for the first waves, and particularly those first waves on those particularly tough killing zones. But thereafter, the fighting at Omaha Beach starts to ease quite substantially. Total Allied dead on Omaha Beach, and some really good recent work has been done into this, is 842, which is a heck of a lot, don't get me wrong. And I'm not, again, I'm not trying to belittle it in any shape or form. But I would suspect that most people think it's a lot worse than that.
Right.
And they do get a foothold pretty quickly. I would say that by kind of 9 o'clock in the morning, it's all over on Omaha Beach. Not the fighting. People are still getting killed well into the afternoon. It's still a kind of dangerous place to be. But the outcome is no longer in doubt. And they don't achieve all their D-Day objectives, but they do the important things. And the most important thing of all is that it doesn't fail. And boy, does it not fail. I mean, D-Day is a huge success.
How big a deal is that?
Had the Allies failed on D-Day, I think there would have been terrible consequences. They wouldn't have been able to mount another amphibious invasion on that scale anytime soon. And that means that the war in Europe would have probably gone nuclear, because that was what the Manhattan Project, the atomic bomb, was designed for initially, later used on the Japanese, but initially designed for the for Germany. And there is also the prospect of the Iron Curtain that followed with the Cold War and the dominance of the Soviet Union and communism across a swathe of Europe would have been much further west, both of which are kind of not nice prospects.
Yeah.
So it really was absolutely important for post-war liberty and freedom and the development of Europe and the world as and the democratic powers that that invasion took place and succeeded. And thank goodness it did.
Well, I'm trying to put it into context. You know, it's hard to think of today a country, you know, ravaging Europe as Germany was, and then another country attacking the U.S. as Japan did. And having to make this decision what to do. And you had people like Dwight Eisenhower, I mentioned the general who was also the future American president, Winston Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt, pulling together. You have these alliances that were formed and seemed sacred. And today, just your thoughts, you have maybe a pulling away from that alliance. You have President Trump, who has considered pulling out of NATO, that military alliance. You know, just your sense of the memory of that time and its legacy, and is it maybe changing?
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting question and such an interesting point, because I think one of the things that really struck me when I was working on this book was the totality of effort. You know, what the Allies are doing, they're coalition partners, they're not formal allies, and they're pulling together. Everyone is honed towards this goal. It is, the logistics of it are absolutely mind-numbing, and they pull it off with bells on, frankly.
Mm.
I think what's interesting and why one should always study history is that history doesn't repeat itself, but patterns of human behavior do. And what you saw after the Wall Street crash and global depression in 1929 and the early 1930s is this rise of nationalism and splintering of the old political order. And what you've seen post-2008 is a similar sort of thing. So we live in troubling times at the moment. And, you know, society is splintering again. I mean, we're incredibly divided at the moment in the UK. There's divisions, I know, in the USA and across the whole of Europe. And what I hope out of the 75th anniversary is that it focuses minds on what actually really is really important and what we value in this life, which is freedom and liberty. And I know that this week, the surviving veterans will be rightly treated like rock stars. You know, they'll be commemorating, but celebrating that freedom. And it's really important that we don't forget it, because I tell you what, you can lose it just like that if you're not careful. So it should be a lesson, a warning, and a remembrance of the huge sacrifice that was made to ensure that we have had these long years of peace in Europe and the Western world ever since.
That's historian James Holland. His new book is Normandy 44, D-Day and the Battle for France. James, thank you so much for an important reminder.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.